طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. And that is why we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts. This week, we take a long look at the sweep of the history of the so-called peace process, which, as it is often said, is more about process than about peace. Palestinian scholar and author Khalid El-Gindi, who has been in the middle of this process as a consultant to the PLO for years, has written a new book called The Blind Spot that takes a critical look at this painful process from the inside. Here he speaks to an audience at the Jerusalem Fund and Palestine Center in Washington, D.C., about his book and where it has taken him. He is introduced by Executive Director Mohammed Mohammed.
Good afternoon. Thanks again for everybody. Thanks for joining us today. My name is Mohammed Mohammed. I'm the executive director here at the Jerusalem Fund and Palestine Center. And on behalf of our board and our staff, it's a pleasure to welcome you here as always. And it's also a pleasure for everybody watching online. Thank you for joining in. It's also a great honor to introduce and welcome back our distinguished speaker, Khalid El-Gindi. He's been here many times, and it's always a pleasure to have you. So thank you, Khalid. Khalid today is going to be speaking about his latest book, which was released just last month. It's called Blind Spot, America and the Palestinians from Balfour to Trump. The United States has invested billions of dollars and countless diplomatic hours in the pursuit of Israeli-Palestinian peace and a two-state solution. Yet American attempts to broker an end to the conflict have repeatedly come up short. Two irreducible factors stand in the way, and those are Israeli power and Palestinian politics. American peacemaking efforts have been hobbled by the U.S. assumption that a credible peace settlement could be achieved without addressing Israel's vast superiority in power or internal Palestinian politics. While there is no denying the roles played by Israelis and Palestinians in perpetuating their conflict, Washington's distinctive blind spot to Palestinian politics and Israeli power has prevented it from serving as an effective peace broker. Shaped by the pressures of American domestic politics and the special relationship with Israel, the blind spot also has deep historical roots dating back to the 1917 Balfour Declaration and the British Mandate over Palestine. The size of the blind spot has varied over the years and from one administration to another, but it is always present, as we all know, unless and until U.S. policymakers are prepared to act in ways that constrain Israeli power and acknowledge Palestinian politics, American peacemaking stands little chance of success. So the copies of the book will be available after the event, so please purchase one on your way out, and I think Khalid will have time to sign them as well, so please do that. And just for those of you who may not be familiar with Khalid, he is a non-resident fellow in the foreign policy program at the Brookings Institution and the author of this newly released book, Blind Spot, America and the Palestinians from Balfour to Trump, which was published by Brookings Institution Press in April last month. He was a resident scholar at the Brookings Institution from 2010 to 2018, where he focused on the Middle East peace process, Palestinian politics, democratization in the Arab world, and related subjects. Prior to arriving at Brookings, Khalid served as an advisor to the Palestinian leadership in Ramallah on permanent status negotiations with Israel from 2004 to 2009. And he was a key participant in the Annapolis negotiations from 2007 to 2008. Khaled has held a number of political and policy-related positions in Washington, both inside and outside outside of government, including as a professional staff member of the U.S. House of Representatives International Relations Committee in 2002, and the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom from 2000 to 2002. He has also held positions at the Arab American Institute and the National Democratic Institute. Khaled's writings have appeared in a wide range of publications, including the Christian Science Monitor, CNN.com, Foreign Affairs, Foreign Policy, the Los Angeles Times, the National Interest, the Washington Quarterly, and others. He is frequently quoted in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times, The Hill, Politico, and other print media, and is a regular commentator on TV and radio, including Al Jazeera, BBC, CNN, Fox News, MSNBC, NPR, PBS NewsHour, and others. Khaled holds an MA degree in Arab Studies from Georgetown University and a BA in Political Science from Indiana University, Bloomington. Today, Khaled will speak for about 20 or so minutes, after which we're going to have a Q&A session and discussion. Please, everybody, join me in giving a very warm welcome to Khaled Al-Kindi.
Thank you, Muhammad, and to all my friends in the Palestine Center. It's a pleasure to be back here, and thank you all for being here. Since Muhammad basically summarized my book, I don't really need to say anything. So I have very little to say. I'm just joking. I actually have a lot to say. So much, in fact, that I wrote a book about it. I thought I would start by defining what exactly is the blind spot and where does it come from. So let me, by way of answering that question, let me kind of zoom out to generalities. I think we all understand intuitively that the success of any negotiation process depends as much on factors outside the negotiating room as whatever happens inside. We all know, for example, that power dynamics are very important. Clearly, the more powerful side has more leverage over the weaker side, has more options, and so forth. And I think we also understand intuitively that both sides have internal politics. And that is to say that when we're negotiating, when you're negotiating with someone, you're not simply negotiating with the people sitting across the table. You're also negotiating, and they themselves are negotiating with their political opposition, their public opinion, their national narratives. All of these things are also at the table. So an effective mediator has to juggle all of these moving parts to be able to come up with ways to encourage the two sides to behave in ways that support the goals of the peace process and to avoid actions that harm the peace process. That's the theory. That's the ideal. But it's not at all how American mediation worked. The tendency by the United States has been essentially to treat the parties as co-equals, as though they were Egypt and Israel, for example, sitting around the negotiating table, two sovereign states talking about how to effect a withdrawal from the Sinai Peninsula, where there's some parity, even though there's always going to be a gap in power and a balance of power, there's at least parity between two sovereign states. The reality, of course, is that not only are Palestinians not a sovereign state, but they are under Israeli occupation. So the tendency has been for U.S. policymakers to downplay the effects, and then especially the negative effects of Israel's occupation on the peace process. On the other side of the equation, in terms of the internal politics, I think we all know that American politicians tend to have enormous sensitivity and deference when it comes to Israeli politics. We can't push the Israeli prime minister too hard on a settlement freeze because it will bring down his ruling coalition, and so we have to carve out these loopholes to allow settlements to, you know, allow them to continue building settlements. We can't have Jerusalem on the agenda in the negotiations because so-and-so from the cabinet will bolt. So there's enormous deference to Israeli politics. And in contrast, there's virtually no deference to Palestinian politics. It's as though Palestinians don't have politics. And that's sort of how I came into this project, really. The aha moment for me was when I was an advisor to the Palestinian negotiating team in the lead up to the Annapolis negotiations. In that moment, in the summer of or early fall of 2007, when President Bush announced that he would convene this conference, it had President Mahmoud Abbas had been in power for 2.5 years. He'd been agitating for a return to permanent status negotiations virtually from the day he took office, and yet there was no process except return to negotiations except in this moment. And what was interesting about this moment was that only a few weeks earlier, Hamas had taken over control of the Gaza Strip, had routed the PA's forces after a brief civil war in the Gaza Strip that Mahmoud Abbas and his Fatah-dominated forces had lost. And a year before that, his Fatah party had lost an election to Hamas. And so here was the Palestinian leader in his absolute weakest in terms of his domestic political situation, and this was the moment. It was very striking to me that this was the moment that the American administration decided would be the opportune moment to move forward on negotiations. This approach to the peace process, of course, is not accidental. The American approach to the Israel-Palestine conflict is shaped by its own power and politics, specifically two key assumptions. The first is that peace can only happen if Israel feels secure militarily, politically, and otherwise. We need to reassure Israeli leaders so that they can, quote, take risks for peace. That's been one of the operating assumptions of the Oslo process really since the early 1990s. And the other is the assumption that it's possible and in some ways desirable to insulate the peace process from Palestinian politics, either by ignoring Palestinian politics altogether or perhaps even reshaping or re-engineering Palestinian politics to fit the needs of the peace process. As Muhammad mentioned in the bio and as I discuss in the book, this approach has deep historical roots, and the blind spot goes back to the time of the Balfour Declaration. And the reason I spend so much time on the history is because I think I'm not going to delve into a lot of the history, except to make a couple points and kind of shed light on why I chose to look at the entire 100-year period as opposed to, say, just since 1967 or since 1948. And the reason is because I think there's an extraordinary amount of continuity in how the United States approaches the Palestinians and Israelis, primarily because it has always kind of seen the issue through a distinctly Zionist slash Israeli lens. And so we can identify three constants throughout this whole 100-year period. The first is an influential Zionist lobby politically. That's always been true. The Zionist lobby in the 1920s was nothing like AIPAC or the pro-Israel lobby today in terms of its power, its reach, its influence. But it was there, and it was a political force. The second constant is related to that, is you have a very sympathetic Congress. So Congress was always sympathetic to the demands of the Zionist movement, even when it was a minority strain within the American Jewish community, which is interesting to know. And it was a minority strand really until the Holocaust, until the early 1940s or late 1930s. The third constant, and I think this is in a lot of ways the most important, is a highly conflicted executive. What does that mean? Well, usually that's manifested in a kind of tension between the State Department and the intelligence community on the one hand, and the White House and the president on the other. And so we have really a pattern where U.S. policy is kind of in tension with itself. There is a tendency to take positions both for and against the same thing at the same time. And so from the very outset, during the mandate, for example, we saw the official U.S. stance with regard to the situation in Palestine was that this was a British matter. The United States was officially neutral, did not take sides, and yet we saw consistently President Wilson and his successors, as well as Congress, consistently expressed very vocal support for the Zionist project and the Jewish national home. So that, you know, that ambivalence, I think, is deeply rooted in American history. Probably the most famous example of this ambivalence is Harry Truman, who before 1947 was against partition, partitioning Palestine, because the State Department and the CIA thought it was contrary to U.S. national interest, that it would alienate the Arab states especially. And then he was for partition. And then immediately after the outbreak of civil war in Palestine following the partition vote, he was against partition again. And then, of course, he was for it. And so there's this constant flip-flopping. But we also see it in other manifestations at various stages as well. One example is the roadmap. The United States wrote the roadmap on behalf of the Quartet. And the Quartet adopted this as its peace plan, but then it immediately abandoned the roadmap. So we have this. We always have this tension between what is seen as in the U.S. interest, based on an assessment usually of State Department and the intelligence community, and then the demands of domestic politics, which pull U.S. policy in a different way. And so we get this very schizophrenic, very often, U.S. policy. And that has a lot to do with U.S. policy failure. The other trend that emerges in this period is very early on, we see a distinct aversion to Palestinian politics, both political actors and Palestinian political aspirations. During the mandate, but especially in the period after Israel's creation, the period between 1948 and 1967, was a crucial period. I think it's one that is very often overlooked, but it's the period when the U.S. approach to the Palestinians and their political leaders were put in place. So even before 1967, even before 1968, when the PLO was taken over by Palestinian guerrilla groups, Fatah being the dominant one, you already have a State Department policy in place that we will not deal with the PLO, even before the PLO is part of the quote-unquote armed struggle. So a lot of these policies just get carried over into from one period into the next. Like I said, I don't want to dwell too much on the historical part, but one of the most important aspects of the historical period, and again, why I chose to look at the entire 100-year period, is the period after 1967, because this is when the PLO really registers onto the scene. This is when Americans, policymakers, begin to see that there is, in fact, a Palestinian dimension to the Arab-Israeli conflict, that it's not strictly a conflict between Arab states and Israel, and that Palestine and Palestinians are at the root of that conflict. So there's a kind of epiphany that happens after 1967 and especially after 1973. And in that period, you have the PLO dramatically rising in its stature and its prominence. In 1974, the PLO is officially recognized by the United Nations. And this creates a dilemma for American policymakers because they don't want to deal with the PLO, both because of Israeli rejection of the PLO and any manifestation of Palestinian nationalism, but also because people like Henry Kissinger, who is a staunch Cold Warrior, see the PLO as a Soviet puppet and as a radicalizing force on the Arab states, and therefore very problematic and needs to be neutralized. And so he institutes this. His sort of worldview is that the PLO is likely to radicalize Arab states, and so if they're going to be brought into the peace process, which hopefully they won't, it needs to be at the very end of the process, after they've been weakened. And so this concept that Kissinger introduces is very important for future, to understand how Americans go about the peace process, because this principle of the PLO as a negative force and Palestinian politics as a pathology, something that needs to be corrected and cured rather than acknowledged and dealt with, is one that figures very prominently thereafter. So from there, I'm going to skip right into the Oslo process and talk about the most important part, which is really how this blind spot worked in practice, in the context of U.S.-led peace process since 1993. So again, these same themes keep cropping up. Every U.S. administration since 1993 has worked both for and against the goals of the peace process at the same time. I gave some examples, like the roadmap. This was not out of ignorance or malice, but basic political arithmetic. The United States and Israel have a close special relationship. They are also the two most powerful parties in this dynamic, whereas the PLO and the Palestinians obviously are the weakest party. And as close allies, they have an interest in deflecting as many of the costs and risks associated with the diplomatic process as they can away from themselves and from each other. And what ends up happening time and time again is that those costs and risks are pushed onto the Palestinians, mainly because of the power dynamics. I'll give some examples. The other component of this, and by, you know, has to do with the nature of the Oslo process itself, which wasn't simply a conflict resolution process like Northern Ireland or Egypt-Israel negotiations. It was also a state-building process where one party was being prepared for statehood, and therefore needed to build its institutions and so on. This led to what I refer to as the Oslo trade-off. The Oslo trade-off was basically an unspoken agreement between the Palestinian leadership and the Americans as the chief sponsor of this process, that from the Palestinian side, the expectation was that the United States would deliver Israel, eventually leading to a Palestinian state. This is a policy or a strategy that emerged in the 1970s, sort of banking on U.S. deliverance as the key to Palestinian statehood. And the other side of this equation from the Palestinian standpoint was that in exchange for the United States giving up, or the United States putting pressure on Israel and eventually to leading to an end to the occupation and allowing the creation of a Palestinian state, in return, the Palestinians were prepared to give up a degree of control over their own politics and decision-making. The PLO, as you will remember, is now transferred out of the diaspora from Tunis into the West Bank and Gaza Strip directly under occupation. And so what this has done, the Oslo process has given, for the very first time, the Israelis and Americans, as well as the broader international community, a direct say in Palestinian politics, which hadn't happened before. And so this is the dynamic that emerges after Oslo. And so it's not entirely a U.S. problem or U.S. deficiency. There is Palestinian agency here, and this is a conscious decision on the part of the Palestinian leadership to give up a measure of control over its own politics as part of that Oslo process. As I said, every U.S. president worked both for and against the goals of the peace process at the same time. President Clinton, I think, to my mind, stands out really as the one who represented both the best and the worst of what American mediation had to offer. On the one hand, he shattered taboos. He invited Yasser Arafat to the White House, the first American president ever to receive this arch-terrorist, Yasser Arafat, at the White House. something like a dozen times over the course of the Oslo process in the late 1990s. He occasionally would use his leverage to boost Arafat, particularly in the after the election of Prime Minister Netanyahu, Benjamin Netanyahu, in 1997. And they had a very contentious relationship, Clinton and Netanyahu. We all remember that famous visit by Clinton to Bethlehem in Gaza, where he addressed the Palestinian public. And so he, I think, understood better than any president before or since the need to boost the Palestinian leadership given the power disparities with Israel. At the same time, he was also the first president to seriously erode U.S. policy and UN precedent in a major way, specifically on issues like settlements in Jerusalem, but also on issues like refugees. So he was, for example, the first U.S. president to not ratify or not vote in favor of UN Resolution 194, which from 1948... that stipulated that Palestinian refugees have the right to return to their homes. So he ended the practice of affirming that resolution. And he also kind of created these carve-outs for the first time on Israeli settlements. You could go ahead and build in the settlements for things like natural growth, build in East Jerusalem, and so on. And so that was the first time we saw major erosion on policies on settlements in Jerusalem as well. But I think Clinton's biggest contribution came after the Camp David summit of July 2000, and subsequent to that, the outbreak of the Palestinian uprising, the Al-Aqsa Intifada, in September of that year. Even though all sides made mistakes, and I think it's clear from the record, whether you're looking at Israeli, Palestinian, or even American sources, that all sides made mistakes going into Camp David and coming out of Camp David, that both sides, Israelis and Palestinians, took actions that sort of led to an escalation of violence. And yet the Clinton administration pinned all of the blame for the failed Camp David summit on Arafat and the Palestinians. And then also put most of the blame in terms of the violence on the Palestinians as well. We understand why, at least I understand why he did that. It's much easier to blame the Palestinians than it is to blame the Israelis in terms of our domestic politics. There were repercussions nonetheless. And among the repercussions were the fact that doing so narrowed the political space available to the leaders in terms of trying to find a successful, trying to negotiate a peaceful resolution in the remaining period that Clinton was in office. And it also emboldened opponents of the peace process. And most of all, it cemented this narrative that the Israelis put forward that the Palestinians were not a partner. And then we get George W. Bush, who comes in the midst of a very violent situation on the ground, a Palestinian uprising, increasing suicide bombings, growing Israeli repression, very often amounting to war crimes, according to many human rights groups. So on the one hand, we have sort of an intensification of this dynamic. Bush is even more conflicted than his predecessor. And the Bush administration represents very much a return to the Kissinger notion of Palestinian politics as pathology. So on the one hand, Bush was the first president to officially call for the creation of a Palestinian state. He made the two-state solution official U.S. policy. At the same time, in the context of the Intifada, Bush also gave Sharon a relative free hand to systematically destroy the Palestinian authority and its governing and security institutions under the umbrella, of course, of fighting terrorism. On the one hand, Bush demanded that Palestinians have to elect new leaders and end the violence before there could be any hope of a diplomatic process, but actually did nothing to push for a diplomatic process after Arafat passed away and Mahmoud Abbas was elected president, which also coincided with an end to the Palestinian uprising in 2005. So even though we have this reduction in violence and a new leadership, there's still no political horizon on the table. Most telling of all was the roadmap, the quartet peace plan that was really spearheaded by the United States in 2003, which was supposed to correct the flaws of the Oslo process by laying out a parallel and mutual, parallel obligations for both sides and mutual accountability. Instead, the Bush administration, as I alluded to earlier, abandoned its own peace plan in favor of Prime Minister Sharon's unilateral Gaza disengagement plan. The failure of that plan, the failure of the Gaza disengagement, eventually weakened Mahmoud Abbas's leadership and led directly to the outcome of the elections, Palestinian elections that were held in early 2006. And this was really, I think, the biggest test for the United States, the election of Hamas that took place in January 2006, like the Intifada, was a sign of a very troubled peace process and an opportunity for course correction. Instead, the Bush administration, again, demanded that all of the costs be paid only by the Palestinians. And so we saw this boycott of the Palestinian Authority, undermining the very institutions that the international community and especially the United States had spent years trying to build up, especially after the Intifada. As in any similar circumstance, when you put sustained pressure on a fragile object, it tends to break. And that's precisely what happened with the Palestinian Authority. We had a civil war in 2007. And then, of course, we had the Annapolis negotiations that I alluded to at the outset, which, of course, also collapsed in late 2008 when fighting broke out between Hamas and Gaza. That brings us to President Obama. By the time Obama came to office, the peace process, both the peace process and Palestinian politics were in shambles. And what they needed more than anything else was a radical new approach that would either correct or at least arrest all of these negative trends. We had the destruction, the massive death and destruction that took place in Gaza, 1,400 Palestinians killed, massive destruction to Palestinian infrastructure. We still had a very divided and dysfunctional Palestinian leadership. Very shortly after Obama took office, we saw the return of a right-wing Israeli government under Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, that was very committed to settlements. And in the intervening years since Oslo, we saw massive growth in the settlement project overall. Obama was genuinely, I think, in a position to reverse or at least arrest these trends and perhaps even break some new ground. But he consistently chose instead to sort of maintain a holding pattern, to do as little as possible that he could get away with politically. And so there were attempts at negotiations, but more or less ignoring the most important realities on the ground, like ongoing settlement activity, the divided and dysfunctional Palestinian leadership, the instability that came from that in Gaza in particular, the fact that Hamas is a free agent beyond the scope of the peace process and now beyond the control of the Palestinian Authority, and therefore could consistently act as a spoiler. All of these things were things that Obama initially hinted at trying to change, but he quickly abandoned. So when he first took office, he talked about a comprehensive settlement freeze. If you remember, George Mitchell was appointed as special envoy for Middle East peace, I think on the second day of Obama's, after his inauguration. And it looked like the Obama administration was going to take a very, very different approach. They would close these loopholes that previous administrations had allowed on things like settlement growth. Obama even hinted at some sort of change with regard to Gaza policy. But at the end of the day, when he got pushback from from Congress in particular, and from members of the pro-Israel community, but even within his own administration, there were some dissent there. He basically abandoned the effort, went back to the old loopholes. Israel can continue to build in Jerusalem, natural growth, all of these kind of carve-outs that previous presidents had done, and Gaza was sort of left to its own devices. Really until 2014. By the time Obama begins his second term in office, there really is no peace process. The idea of a peace process really exists only in name. And for example, despite the success of Prime Minister Salam Fayyad's state-building and institution-building project, which brought corruption to an all-time low, improved the efficiency and governance of the Palestinian Authority, dramatically, you know, reformed the security services in a way that led to a massive reduction in violence against Israelis. There was not a parallel reduction in violence against Palestinians, however. And yet, despite that success, we saw no movement toward ending the occupation or a Palestinian state. In 2014, we saw another attempt at negotiations that again collapsed, followed shortly thereafter by renewed violence again in Gaza and also in Jerusalem, which, interestingly enough, are also the two areas that were both outside of the scope of the peace process. They were excluded from this process for various reasons. And outside of the reach, beyond the reach of the Palestinian Authority. So it's not a coincidence that they are also the main sources of instability. And so by this time, the state-building project has collapsed, negotiations have collapsed, violence has become a recurring phenomenon. And so we really have neither peace nor process. You know, we used to talk about the peace process was all process and no peace, but by this stage, really, there's not even really a process to speak of. The parties are simply left to their own devices, and the administration is sort of a bystander, even at this stage. Even as the clock wound down on the Obama administration with a president-elect Donald Trump waiting in the wings, here was another opportunity to take some radical step to bookmark the two-state solution, to move the ball forward, since we already knew quite a bit about the inclinations of the incoming Trump administration. Some people had speculated that maybe Obama would put forward final status parameters that would include issues like Jerusalem, to sort of put a pin in a Palestinian state with Jerusalem as its capital. But he didn't do that. Some also suspected that maybe, just maybe, he would recognize a Palestinian state, perhaps as a last-ditch effort. He also did not do that. Instead, what he did was, again, the absolute bare minimum of what a president could do, which was to approve an abstention at the United Nations, his first and only abstention. He's the only president to abstain only one time in a resolution against Israeli settlements or other Israeli actions. And so it was an important resolution, and it was allowed to pass the Security Council as a result. But that was the absolute minimum that could be done. And so then we come to Donald Trump. The inertia of the Obama years left the door wide open for Trump and his administration, which, as we now know, is much less committed to a two-state solution and is much more committed to radically changing the rules of the game. We've heard a lot of talk about Trump's peace plan. My view is that the details actually don't matter of Trump's peace plan, which keeps getting delayed, kind of, you know, they keep kicking the can down the road. But it actually doesn't matter if the plan is released or it isn't released, because we know the broad outlines already. We know that Jerusalem is off the table. Those are the words that Trump used. We know that refugees are also off the table because we've canceled. Well, Clinton had already sort of taken the issue off the table, but Trump put the final nail in the coffin of the refugee issue by defunding UNRWA, which had been a policy in place even since since Israel's creation in 1948 and 1949. We know that their policy does not include a sovereign Palestinian state, much less a capital in East Jerusalem. Instead, what we hear is that the Palestinians will get some form of expanded autonomy and probably the infusion of some massive economic assistance program, most likely from Arab states. In a very real sense, though, Trump is not a new approach to the peace process, as he very often tries to claim, but the culmination of the old approach. So Trump is no longer committed to the Land for Peace formula enshrined in UN Resolution 242. We saw that most recently in the announcement with regard to the Golan Heights. But the basic ground rules of the peace process and the Land for Peace formula had already been eroded by presidents before him repeatedly, specifically by Presidents Clinton and George W. Bush. The current administration doesn't recognize the occupation. They've scrubbed that term, occupied territories, from the official lexicon of the State Department and official reports. But already for years we've seen U.S. administrations downplay the significance and centrality of Israel's occupation. And even, frankly, the Democratic Party refuses to acknowledge, at least in their 2016 platform, declined to talk about Israel's occupation. At the same time that the Republican Party had removed any reference to the occupation and, in fact, referred, sort of entered a new realm of occupation denial. This is the new rhetoric of the Republican Party, is grounded in a denial that Israel is, in fact, an occupying state at all. And so we see these policies reflected in the statements and actions of the current Trump administration. But even things like the move of the embassy, the American embassy to Jerusalem, and the closure of the PLO mission, very dramatic departures from past U.S. presidents, these were laws that were passed in the 1990s and that finally were implemented or came to fruition under Trump. So there is a lot more continuity than change, I believe, in terms of the Trump administration. In my opinion, the Trump administration is trying to redefine the conflict and its resolution by turning back the clock, not to the pre-Oslo period before 1993, but to the pre-1967 period, and perhaps even pre-1948 period, when the Palestinians were viewed mainly as an economic, humanitarian, and a security problem rather than a political one. The bottom line, and I will end here, is that the Middle East peace process failed under U.S. management because it was fundamentally detached from reality. It was more focused on things like reassuring Israel and reforming the Palestinians than it was on challenging the basic conditions that define and sustain the conflict, namely Israel's now 51-year-old occupation. We see this in the failure to implement any sort of accountability, particularly when it comes to the stronger party, Israel. We see this in the absence, the absence of pressure on Israel did not make Israeli leaders more likely to, quote, take risks for peace, but instead defrayed the costs of its occupation in military, economic, and political terms. Likewise, attempts to neutralize or re-engineer Palestinian politics did actually make Palestinian leaders more pliant, but also made them too weak to serve as effective peace partners. Thank you.
You have been listening to Palestinian scholar and author Khalid El-Gindi speaking about his new book, The Blind Spot. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at wzbc.org. To access our permanent archive to hear any of our past broadcasts, go to truthandjusticeradio.org. That's truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, and click on This Week in Palestine Archive. This archive was developed and is maintained by our colleague Stan Robinson. We thank you for your time and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.